The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
So it's been an interesting time here in college football, something we've never experienced before. Welcome to the College Football Podcast with Herb Street, Pollock, and Nagandi. We taped a podcast on Tuesday with Pollock and Andrea Adelson, and then we had to scrap it. And like the situation we are in right now when it comes to sports, sometimes the best laid plans, you just got to improvise and move on. And that's what we did. So we have a new podcast coming out Wednesday as we've just finished taping, and with new information coming in as the Big 12 Board of Directors agreed to proceed with plans for the fall sports season. And that continues our conversation as three Power Five conferences will try to move on and try to have a college football season and see how that plays out. And on this podcast, we've got the information from Mark Schlabaugh, fantastic reporting across the board, and the background on the decision-making process and what played a huge role for the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and their decisions and what had changed over the last week. Fantastic perspective from Ivan Maisel on the history of the game and what this means and what ADs are going through, as well as, you know, the landscape down the road and how it may change in 2021 and 2022 in college football after this decision here in the fall. And the great Reese Davis, College Game Day's Reese Davis, joining us with his perspective on what this all means right now, how he feels about having a season down the road, you know, and when we put our optimistic glasses on, could we have a playoff, as well as tackling the issue of spring football? If that is even viable or realistic, big picture, suggested by the Pac-12 as well as the Big Ten, and what that all could mean. So we do hope you enjoy this podcast. We're going to go with the information first and start with Mark Schlabaugh. And it's so good to have Mark Schlabaugh. I'm going to just say college sports reporter, because you are covering the football aspect as well as the basketball aspect better than anybody I know. And you're knee deep into what's going on in the landscape in college football on a very busy day yesterday, a day we've never seen before in the sport. And then last night, word from the Big 12 started leaking out that they are going to at least move on, as for now, on having a season, and then an official statement that they will have fall sports coming our way. But now they've kicked this can down the curb a little bit, down the road a little bit, where September 26th, it looks like it's going to be the start date to the season, joining the SEC. Mark, what more can you tell us about this decision and the concept that at one point last night, it felt like the Big 12 had all the keys when it came on August 11th on whether we were going to have a college football season in the fall?
No, I agree with you. I think they were the linchpin. I think the SEC would have been prepared to go alone with the ACC. I'm not entirely sure the ACC would have gone with the SEC alone. I think the fact that you've got three Power Five conferences, you know, the majority, three out of the five, moving forward with the intention of playing this fall, I think if the Big 12 had said no, I don't think we're having any discussions about the possibility of college football being played this fall.
Mark, how did we get here? Because the one question I kept on asking yesterday to many of our guests on SportsCenter, we expanded to 4.5 hours, you know, yesterday being Tuesday, Friday last week, I felt pretty good. Not saying that we were going to have a season, but I felt pretty good about the coming weeks. And then Saturday, the news from the MAC deciding that they won't have fall sports. What changed, especially from the Big Ten's point of view, where 6 days earlier they released the schedule to saying, no, we're going to postpone fall sports? What changed in their mindset? Also, how did that play in the role with the reporting that you and Paula Levine have done? Fantastic reporting when it came to a rare heart condition.
Yeah, I commend Paula. She's the one who first heard about it late last week, maybe Wednesday, Thursday of last week. She was told that the presidents and chancellors of the Big Ten and the Pac-12 were becoming concerned about myocarditis, which is the inflammation of the heart muscle We were told there were at least five Big Ten student athletes, not all football players, who had suffered heart ailments after battling COVID-19. And then there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which suggested that myocarditis is more prevalent with COVID-19 than it is with other viruses, like mono and the common cold and the flu. It can cause inflammation of the heart, but there are some studies, limited studies, and anecdotal evidence that suggests it occurs with the coronavirus at a much higher rate, and that alarmed a lot of the presidents and chancellors and athletic directors, and I think it's one of the big reasons those two leagues decided to pull the plug.
Where is the disconnect, though, Mark, when you have medical advisory boards here? And you know, we've talked about this extensively during the pandemic. When you don't have a unified voice, you don't have unified testing, you don't have a plan where, you know, the Power Five conferences can get on the same page on what they want to do. And granted, they're in different regions throughout the country where you have different protocols to follow state by state. But where's the disconnect when you have medical advisory boards making these suggestions in the Pac-12, in the Big Ten, yet we have different information in the ACC and the SEC, and looks like the Big 12 going forward here, especially when we're talking about this massive concern surrounding a rare heart condition?
Kevin, I would say, in my opinion, sadly, the biggest problem in our society is also the biggest problem in college sports. Lack of cooperation, division. It's just, I agree with you. It's amazing that, you know, we talked to a doctor at the University of Washington in Seattle, cardiologist, who's one of the main medical advisors for the NCAA. And he said, look, with this condition, they got to stop all contact, put everything on pause, and we got to figure out more about this. And there are going to be disagreements among doctors about this condition because, you know, it was very, very rare in the past. It seems to be more prevalent with coronavirus. And, you know, people, doctors, physicians, some of the smartest people in the world disagree on how much of a risk it is. But the problem is, each of these conferences has their own medical board, their own doctors. They don't all agree. And the worst part about it is, from what we have gathered, they're not sharing a lot of information. We don't know how many student athletes might have this in the SEC, or how many in the Big 12, or how many in the Big 10. And there are a couple of doctors that are trying to go to these conferences and to go to the NCAA and say, look, we need data. We need to find out how many kids have this. We need to find how many kids have been tested after COVID. And for the most part, you know, the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12 think they have a handle on it, because any kid who tests positive for COVID-19, once he recovers, they're giving him EKGs. They're giving him the blood test to see if they have the proteins in their blood. They feel like they can handle it and give them the right treatment. Not everybody has access to that, and that's part of the concern. But the lack of transparency, act of cooperation, I think, is the biggest problem.
How are they not sharing this information? It is mind-boggling when you're trying to figure this out together. And this goes back to the common root. And listen, Paul Feinbaum and I had some fun with this yesterday, talking about it on SportsCenter, that there's reasons why we love this sport, because it's such a quirky thing, right? There's the competition level is nonstop regardless. And it feels like this is a game of musical chairs, and who's going to be left standing when the music stops, and who's going to blink first. And they're carrying this out here this far into the pandemic without coming together. I'm blown away by that. I get the idea of competition off the field when it comes to recruiting. I get it when it comes to the idea on the field. I get it when it comes to the idea of, you know, our fan base is bigger than yours. I don't get it why there is a lack of cooperation when it comes to medical attention across the board with these five conferences. It is mind-boggling, and I'm sorry I'm going on a rant here, Mark, but that plays a huge role on this indecisiveness, and it's not fair to the athletes or the coaches who for 6 weeks said, we will follow the rules, and it seems like they have followed the rules, and they've complied, and yet they do not get rewarded in the end.
No, I agree with you. It is mind-boggling. And look, I mean, I know there is a doctor at Emory University in Atlanta who's consulting the SEC, who's one of the foremost authorities on this. And from what, you know, he apparently doesn't think it's that big of a concern. We saw the doctor from Duke University on Tuesday come out and tell the Sports Business Journal that he doesn't, you know, he feels like they can mitigate the risk and that they feel it's safe to play football this fall and play other fall sports. And I'm not going to question the credentials of a Duke University physician. There is a disconnect, and why some people feel it's more of a concern than others, you know, I don't know the answer to. But again, going back to my original assessment, division, and I think where you're located, you know, the politics of this, obviously some states and governments have taken the pandemic more seriously than others. And, you know, I just think, you know, for some presidents in the SEC and the Big 12 and the ACC, I think they would probably take more criticism and flack from their constituents for canceling the season than they would for not canceling the season.
That's a fair point. And you mentioned the NCAA. It's funny that we haven't talked about the NCAA. Somewhere Mark Emmert is just watching everybody and how this plays out. What's their role here, considering they don't have power in college football to a certain extent? What's their role in this whole thing?
They put out medical guidelines. Brian Hainline, their director of medicine, is everything he can within his power. He's put out guidelines. They advise the schools that, they can't force kids to sign waivers. But beyond that, we haven't heard a lot of them from them. They're going to talk about eligibility and transfer waivers on Wednesday, and the Board of Governors we'll vote on that next week to see if some of these kids from the Big Ten and the Pac-12, if these other leagues do end up playing, whether they have the ability to transfer to other schools. But I haven't been as critical of the NCAA as others have in the past. But I just think at this point it's a rudderless ship, and I think it's headed really to where it's going to have no place at the table of big time college athletics anymore.
It is now turning into the wild wild west, and. How much does this decision by the Big Ten and the Pac-12 when it comes to liability? How much? I mean, it feels like in the end, the presidents make these decisions, not the commissioner, not the AD. It's the presidents. How much of the liability of the unknown and the long-term effects played a role here? And the other side, how much did the concept of giving more power to the players who were asking for transparency and the ability to have medical coverage down the road off of something like this, how much did that play a role in this decision as well from these two conferences?
No, I think all of it was a factor. In terms of liability, I saw Thomas Mars, an attorney who's worked with some NCAA cases in the past, was quoted earlier today on Wednesday saying that, he's talked to some of the most talented attorneys in the country, and they're praying that the SEC and ACC and Big 12 play because they'll have a lot of cases to litigate.
Wow.
But look, the waiver part of it, a liability waiver, they're tough to prove. If a kid's playing college football, you can't say he didn't pick it up in his dorm, he didn't pick it up in his apartment, a bar or a grocery store. But I think more than that, I just think from an ethical and moral standpoint, if God forbid one of these kids were to get really, really sick or worse, I just don't think a university president would want that on his or her hands. So I think that's part of it. In terms of the empowerment, I think that's something that's going to be hashed out over the next several months. I think in terms of the Pac-12, the Pac-12 United movement, I didn't have many issues with that other than the 50-50 revenue sharing. I don't think the middle of a pandemic is the right time to come to the table mm-hmm. and make those sort of decisions. I think they made it a little bit easier for Larry Scott and the Pac-12 presidents and chancellors to pull the plug. If it was going to be that difficult to pull it off with everything already stacked against them in terms of testing and community spread and some state and city ordinances that were going to make competition really, really hard to begin with, I think they said, look, if it's going to be this difficult, it's maybe not worth it.
And And then we don't know what's going to, how this is going to play out in let's just say the spring. And I say that because the one thing that college athletics does not have, when you look at the professional sports and their associations and their unions, is stability, because every 2 to 3 years, the turnover rate and which players are going to try to continue to fight in the spring. You know, especially with when you have a movement saying, you know, got a handful of guys that are going to the next level in the NFL. And I don't want to say they move on, but who's going to carry the torch afterwards, right? And if maybe the hope is for some of these conferences that they don't want to face this head on, and for player empowerment by saying, hey, maybe things will die down and some of the people that are behind this will not be as involved in the fall, because now in the spring they're getting involved into something else, which is potentially preparing for the NFL draft. That has been my biggest thing. I love what the players are doing here with this Players United across the board throughout the country. But to sustain it, and who's going to pass the baton, you know, class after class after class, is the biggest issue that they will always have in college athletics. Who's going to maintain the power, because you're going to have so many people come in and come out. When that leads into the next discussion, what are you hearing about spring football, and how feasible is this? Because this felt like the announcement of the Big Ten and the Pac-12 mentioning spring football was like, we'll deal with that later. But when you actually look at the situation, I'm not sure it's doable with a couple of things. You're trying to fit two seasons in 12 months, and we do not have any clarity on the concept of who is going to be eligible, who's going to have scholarships, what about early enrollees, all of that dynamic, and who's going to be on the team, because I would assume at least 50 to 80 to 100 of the NFL prospects that are potentially picked on day one and day two, where they're hearing it from agents now, why are we playing in the spring? We have nothing to play for. What are you hearing about the feasibility of spring football?
It's not a very popular option. I mean, we've been discussing it with ADs and coaches and employers and commissioners for the last several months. It was always the last option, least popular option. I think if it's the only option, they may have to do it. I think from a financial standpoint, you know, even some of these really big athletic departments are headed towards, you know, financial ruin. You know, Paul and I did a piece back in May, I believe, just about the state of college athletics in terms of finances. And there's $4.2 billion at stake. And the most alarming thing to me was that in a $4.2 billion industry, only 41% of the athletic departments actually had financial reserves, which is mind-boggling that you can make that much money and spend it that fast. But, Kevin, that was kind of the model, right? Spend all the money you make so there's not enough to pay the players.
Yeah.
You're building the facilities and you're paying your coordinators $2 million a year. So I think it's going to be a really big reset for big-time college athletics. I think you're going to see a lot of the bells and whistles go away. Maybe be a little bit more prudent and conservative in the spending. But in terms of spring football, you know, Barry Alvarez has said, we got to figure out a way to do it, even if it's only a 6 or an 8 game schedule. You know, they're in a better position than most. They do have $100 million in reserves, more than $100 million. So they can bear it more than most. But I think schools like Rutgers, Maryland, even UCLA and Cal Berkeley, you know, those are institutions with athletic departments that were getting a tremendous amount of money from direct institutional support and student fees, and that money may not be there. And that's going to put those schools in really rough financial shape. So I think you got to figure out a way to recoup some of the money from this year, even if it's a season in the spring. And if Trevor Lawrence doesn't play and Chuba Hubbard doesn't play and Justin Fields doesn't play, you know, you got to take what you can get during a pandemic.
I will say this, though. Why would they want to play, right? It's the guys that have something to prove that are getting a third day grade. They may want to play. I mean, it could have been Joe Burrow a year ago, right? Because he was a fringe guy trying to get an opportunity. But why would anybody that's projected to go inside the top potentially, let's just say, 100. Why would they want to jeopardize that? And I could see agents, you know, and I'm already hearing that agents are everywhere. now more than ever, because people are questioning what they're going to do for the next 9 months before the draft leading into it. You mentioned one other thing before I let you go, and it was a huge storyline yesterday, is Nebraska. I can't recall when you have a statement coming out from the chancellor, the president, the AD, and the coach all together, not just Scott Frost's words from a couple days ago, but it's coming from everybody in unison that they still want to find a way to play. What else have you heard about whether this is, you know, logistically possible, breaking off from the Big Ten? And then the idea that the Big 12 announced that a 9+1, and we're talking about Nebraska and their ties to the Big 12, there's a 9+1 schedule that they just announced where they could potentially line up Big 12 teams. What are you hearing about this being even realistic, and what could be the penalty?
Legally, I don't know. I mean, I've tried to talk to some people, and they're not entirely sure. I mean, obviously, the Big 10 and ABC, ESPN, and the other networks affiliated with the Big Ten own those broadcast rights. Can you go buy them back? I don't think so. You know, do you take it to court? You know, there are force majeure clauses in every contract. I don't know if there's one in the, you know, in Nebraska's contract with the Big Ten, but it certainly was surprising. I mean, I give Scott Frost credit. I mean, he stood up for his players. He wanted to play. He looked good for his players. I don't think they're going to have a problem recruiting anytime soon. They'll probably recruit better than they have.
Exactly. That's what I thought. I thought immediately that this is a certain look for a coach, because then you saw Jim Harbaugh, you saw Ryan Day, you saw James Franklin. Then it became like a race in recruiting, right? I've got to say something because somebody else is saying something. I just have never seen a president and a chancellor speak out together on the same page with the coach on something like this.
I don't. Yeah. And I here's one statement I'll make. I don't think that happens under Jim Delaney.
Yep.
Jim Delaney is still Big Ten commissioner because he'd been there for so long and he had so much power. And they've got Kevin Warren, a new commissioner, less than a year on the job, you know, kind of testing him a little bit. But I give the coaches and the ADs and the presidents credit for standing up for their kids. I mean, Gene Smith, the Ohio State AD, came out and said he and the interim president there wanted to delay it and not postpone it. You know, they've done everything their universities have asked them to do in terms of being responsible and, you know, quarantining and isolating and not spreading it. And the test results, you know, have shown that they were making it work. But, you know, in the end, the presidents and chancellors and the commissioner followed the medical advice.
And we'll see how that plays out for the other three conferences in the coming weeks. And, you know, I guess the real test is by, you know, pushing back the start of the season. The real test will begin when students come back, and coinciding with when players can put pads on. That seemed like a big issue. And Mark, let's hope that the next time we're on, we have better news to talk about. I appreciate you joining us here in the College Football Podcast and keeping us up to date on this Wednesday and a very busy week in college football.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And it's great to have College Game Day's Reese Davis joining us here in the College Football Podcast. Reese, how would you, you know, with the news coming from the Big 12 today, the official announcement that fall sports will continue at this time, how would you characterize the last 24 hours, starting with the Big 10, the Pac-12, and now the Big 12 news?
I think it's not unexpected based on what we saw the last few days, but it nonetheless is bizarre. It's one thing to anticipate something intellectually and then actually have it happen and realize that, you know, Ohio State and Michigan played, you know, for 100 years or whatever. And the Buckeyes, I think particularly, played through the Spanish flu and world wars. And yet, you know, all of a sudden they're not playing. And I'm not being critical. They made the decision that they thought was best for their conference, meaning the Big Ten. Obviously Ohio State differed a little bit, but, you know, just the reality of what we will not experience this fall that is such an important part of the fabric of our culture and such an important part to the region and the Big Ten, and we're not going to have it. It's huge. As far as the Big 12, it's been very peculiar and a little perplexing to me, just to be candid, why any other conference is waiting on the Big 12 instead of the other way around, given, you know, given the way realignment went and everything else, and just in terms of the power structure. But I'm sure there are many underneath the surface reasons for that. If for nothing else, just having three of the five with designs, still having designs on playing, as opposed to having just one or two of the five.
And you still have the power of Texas and Oklahoma, and their backing is they want to see if they could have a fall football season. If hypothetically we had news that the Big 12 said, you know, we want to postpone the fall, do you think that would have put the ACC and the SEC in a position where not so much that they want to play, but how can they play with just only two Power Five conferences?
I would say this. I mean, everything we've read, and I don't know it to be true. I haven't gotten anyone from the ACC to confirm this, but the speculation has been that the ACC might follow suit. That said, the SEC is not going to allow anyone to dictate to them what they're going to do. They're going to exhaust every effort to make the best decision they can. Now, Kevin, they might still arrive at the very same place and not play. And that's something I think that needs to be underscored. I think that that Greg Sankey has been prudent and wise and patient more than anything else in establishing this, but he at no time has said that they were going to play at any cost. He has not said that. And he has not implied that. They've just been patient. I think it would leave the SEC in an untenable situation if they were the last one standing, I think, simply because of the optics. But from all of my discussions with people within the SEC, they're very, and the ACC for that matter, very confident in their medical research and their medical people, but certainly eager to look at all of the information that has been gathered by the Big Ten and the Pac-12. Which, by the way, should be shared with all of us, just, you know, for the record. Because, look, you know, I'm in my 50s now, and if I were to contract this, and, you know, I'd want to know if I am at an elevated risk for, you know, any type of cardiac deal. It might impact, you know, whether you exercise, all of those types of things. My point in saying that is that the general public, in addition to football players, could benefit from this knowledge. So it all should be shared so that people can make the wisest and safest decisions. And I think that's what the conferences are. I think they're committed to trying to do their best. I'm not saying they'll be foolproof. I'm not saying everyone will agree, but they're going to try to make the best decision they can for their members, for their players, because I push back against anybody who suggests that these administrators, whether it be presidents or commissioners or athletic directors or whoever, is acting with callous disregard toward player health. I don't believe that. Now, certainly they are motivated by wanting to have the money that would come from playing a season. There is no question about that. That's just common sense. But I don't think those are mutually exclusive categories.
What kind of pressure do you think Kevin Warren's under? You know, this is year one, and you get some public brushback from coaches, which, you know, I talked to Mark Schlabel and Ivan Mizell about this specifically, where, you know, a couple days ago, some of these coaches are speaking out. It kind of felt like they're sticking up for their players, but also it was their own recruiting battle. Oh, look, I'm going to stick up. Oh, somebody else needs to issue a statement as well in the Big Ten. And somebody else. It's just yesterday with Nebraska coming out with the chancellor, the president, the AD, as well as the coach coming out and saying, we still believe we could find a way to play. We're looking forward to an opportunity. What kind of pressure is Kevin Warren going through in year one?
He's having to deal with a situation that no commissioner has ever well, maybe that's overstating it, but that you don't really envision when you take a job like that. Where do you draw the line between free speech and insubordination, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, I mean, people have a right to differ and have differing opinions, and, you know, something that has been challenged beyond football, certainly in our culture. But at the same time, the Big Ten has a long history of unity. Mm-hmm. And I think it is one of the things that, you know, I got to know Kevin a little bit right around the Rose Bowl. It was the first time I had met him. I've been impressed with him. This is a really, I can't imagine a more difficult circumstance to be put in your first year as a commissioner, because Kevin, you know this from the time that you spent covering this sport, that you have to earn trust. and there was precious little time. You can have respect, and I think everyone in college athletics had great respect for Kevin's resume, but they were still getting to know him, right? And that, the same would ring true for the people within his own conference. And whereas, when Jim Delaney was there and he so brilliantly ran the Big Ten for a number of years, perhaps people would have been less inclined and more inclined to, even if they vehemently disagreed, to take a step back before airing it publicly. That said, I don't think this has been a good look at all for Nebraska and for Scott Frost, a person that I like and respect very much. I understand the desire to stand up for the players, but I think the tone and the tenor of the remarks have been a miss. And, I understand being upset, and I think there's a way to do it a bit more diplomatically. I actually think Gene Smith probably led the way with that, saying we would have preferred to push back, but this is where we stand right now.
Yeah, you can publicly disagree, but at the same time still be respectful and not just cast blame, and that's it. And then moving on and saying we're fighting for ourselves here. That's the issue with the statements, especially, a couple days ago, what Frost said, I had no problem with, because I'm like, that's a coach who's very passionate and he's talking about his players and his players can get behind and it won't hurt him with recruiting. It's yesterday's statement where you have, people well above his pay grade making these decisions with him.
Well, maybe way himself. Above his stature. I don't know if he was well above his pay grade. Maybe well above his place in the corporate structure, but I'm not sure about the other.
Figure of speech, yes.
Yeah.
Now, moving forward here, as we try to kind of figure things out about a fall schedule, the one thing that stood out to me is what the Pac-12 did by saying the calendar year, not just fall sports, the calendar year. And that bleeds into something that also you're aware of and tied into, and that is College game day basketball wise. How do you think this now kind of sets the tone with basketball down the road as we look at 2021 for the Pac-12, which is a power when it comes to hoops?
I think that, we focused on the Big Ten because I think the Pac-12 geographically within their footprint, whether it's virus outbreaks, local ordinances, whatever it might be, I think they're dealing with a little bit different set of circumstances than a lot of the programs in other regions of the country. So I think that created more of an issue for them. As it pertains directly to basketball, I really think, much like everything else, it's going to have to follow the virus because, an indoor game as opposed to an outdoor game, you still have very close contact. Everybody understands football. There's going to be sweating on each other and all of that, but that's even magnified in basketball, albeit with fewer people. So, I think it's probably going to just follow the same health and safety protocols that we've seen about how feasible it is to have a basketball season, when the basketball season will be able to start. Will it be able to start, in the areas that are still attempting to see if they can play football? Will it be able to go there and not in other places? I think all of those things remain to be seen, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. In fact, I expect that everybody to at least roll back the start of basketball season and push it into deeper into the year, absent some type of breakthrough treatment, vaccine, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, and you could focus those, everybody's gone through it and understands that once January rolls around, you're playing conference basketball, right? And you don't get those trips that we're normally seeing to Madison Square Garden, and you're combining conferences, and maybe that's what we have to live with, the reality in the spring. Do you think, back to football and the discussion of spring, we will have spring football, or do you think this is just hope that's being passed down the road and then they will deal with it at another time?
Oh, I'm sure that some of them want to, and I don't doubt the good intentions, but as I told you on SportsCenter the other day, I think the notion is ludicrous, simply because so much effort has gone into player safety. And concussion certainly jumps to the top of the list, and the amount of contact. And I went back through and read all of the practice protocols and sort of did some rudimentary math about what it would take and the increase in the number of contact days, even though, game collisions are typically more violent and more prevalent than you would see typically in practice. Although you certainly have big collisions and injuries in practice, but you would increase by a pretty significant number the number of days of contact. You would increase the most intensive nature of that contact in games, and be asking them to play, you know, 20 games in 10 months or 11 months, and go along with the necessary contact that would come with trying to get the players ready for the season. Then even beyond that, just from a strength and conditioning standpoint, and I'm not trying to espouse myself as an expert on this, but I have done quite a bit of looking into it. There's a period of time in terms of recovery, then guys that in terms of their development that need a certain amount of time to safely gain or lose weight or gain or lose strength or mobility in different parts of their body. All of these things that come with an extended calendar, then you start condensing it and then ratcheting up the intensity of the collisions. It just doesn't seem responsible for a sport that in recent years has gone to tremendous measures to limit contact to games and reduce as much as possible in a sport like football, the risk of repeated collisions. And, you know, it just doesn't seem reasonable to me. I'm sure that I know people want to see football, and I'm not sitting here telling you that I'm going to, you know, stand up and pound my fist and stick my bottom lip out and pout and not watch. I mean, I'll watch, of course, if I'll enjoy it, and I'm sure the players will enjoy playing it. But I'm just saying, from a big philosophical picture, when we've spent so much time as those who cover the sport, you know, and trying to hold the sport accountable, and the sport itself trying to hold itself accountable for safety, it doesn't make any sense to try to condense two seasons, even if they're truncated. Unless you ridiculously truncate them to, you know, like four games in the spring and 10 games in the fall, then maybe that's a different thing. But I'm not sure anybody's signing up for that to begin with. So I don't think we're going to see college football played in the spring.
I'm not expecting you to, I'm not expecting you to give me an answer where I'm going to hold you to it. But as we tape this podcast on a Wednesday, August 12th, what is your best case scenario you think in the fall if we have the three conferences playing? Do you think we get 6 to 8 games in? Do you think we potentially see 9 games? Do you think we potentially see a playoff? Where are you right now on the idea and the hope of college football in the fall?
I'd leaned for the first time since, you know, we started discussing this, I had crossed over the 50% threshold into the pessimistic side over the weekend. With some of the medical things that I've read, and still certainly pending the evaluation of the conferences and what type of cardiac screening might already be underway, which I know several of these programs already do pretty extensive cardiac screening, and how that might play into the risk management of playing football. I would say I'm 51-49 that slightly back into the optimistic side that we'll get it started. I have no way of knowing how many games or even how to guess whether it would be successful. I do think, Kevin, that under that scenario, if they started and were only able to play, you know, 4 or 5 games, 6 games, whatever it is, I think that would prove to have been a misstep if that's the case. Now we don't have a way to 100% control the virus. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and cast blame at anyone if that happens to be the case. If you just all of a sudden have this outsurge and it becomes necessary as it did in the spring to stop sports or whatever, you know, but I think that they'll get started. And if they can somehow get started, play a legitimate schedule, which I would deem as, you know, minimum 8 games, hopefully all 10 if they do get started, then I think they'll select 4 and play the playoff. I mean, if they've gotten that far and have been able to do it, safely or as safely as possible, then I would assume they would go ahead and finish the deal.
All right. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Let's just get to September 26th. Before September 26th, let's just get the kids in school and practice with pads, right?
Young people on campus, and hopefully not any serious outbreaks, and hopefully we can, you know, get this under control for the good of the population at large.
100% well said there, and thank you for making sure it's young men and women on campus and making sure that they are safe and healthy. And I wish you and your family good health and safety. And hopefully, as I mentioned it to Ivan as well as Mark, the next time we have you on the podcast, we're actually talking about football on the field. I appreciate it, RD.
That'd be awesome, Kevin. If you see any bears up on your street, don't send them down to my block, all right?
RD, I almost hit a baby one the other day.
You got to watch out, man.
Yeah. And if I would have even come close, that the mama would have come out and I would have been done. So.
Oh, that would have been a bad deal for you, man.
RD. I'm sorry.
All right, see you guys.
And it's so good to have Ivan Maisel join us here on the College Football Podcast. Ivan, I said it a couple times on SportsCenter yesterday, actually more than a couple times, considering we were on for 4.5 hours. I mentioned college football has never seen a day like this before, and that was yesterday on the announcement from the Big Ten as well as the Pac-12 postponing fall sports and potentially pushing the hope down the road on spring football for both conferences. As a man who appreciates the great history of college football, how would you sum up yesterday and the week that we're having and what's in front of us?
Oh, wow. Well, Kevin, this is a singular event in the history of a game, and we'll get through it. 2020 season is barely surviving. And I think really the 2021 season, almost by definition, is going to be unusual as well, depending on when the schools can play and how late they have to go into 2020 is going to affect when we play 2021. So hopefully by 2022, everything will be back to normal and whatever normal is at that point. But I think there are some parallels both to wartime football and World War, in the 40s and to the war and flu pandemic football of 1918. We can look back that far.
And I know you're making that I've seen some comparisons on the idea that, kids still played. It's just a different dynamic here when we talk about the liabilities and the unknown about the health status. And honestly, the way college football, the landscape looks now from what it was 100 years ago, right? When we had, the flu and people were concerned. It wasn't a billion-dollar industry with over 130 teams traveling and those concerns and issues. Yeah, you mentioned one thing about how 2021 is going to be affected. Let's just talk about how I get to the landscape here on everybody. There's going to be massive cuts here, especially when you do not have the college football income. Do you think that we're going to see a complete makeover reset, as Mark Schlabel and I touched on right now on this college football podcast, where we won't see the lavish spending anymore? We will see a lot more prudent choices being made, and we'll see better decision-making. What do you foresee in 2021 as a result of this?
Well, that's a great point by Mark. And just as an aside, I would advise the listeners that there's nothing wrong with your listening device. Mark and I just talk slowly, so it's fine. It's a great opportunity to reset. And if money is tight, then I think maybe the days of the non-revenue sports traveling across the country to play their competition, that may go by the wayside and would be a smart and prudent way to begin to save money. And there's really no reason you couldn't do that in every sport. I did a piece last week in which I talked to Kansas athletic director Jeff Long and Barry Alvarez at Wisconsin about the emotional toll of having to make these kind of difficult decisions. And one thing I noticed, and I'm not picking on them, it's just that this is, I just pulled up the schedule and looked at it. The Kansas women's golf team played twice in Florida last year, last winter. And that's when you can play golf. If you're going to play golf in the winter, that's where you have to go to play it. But why do they have to do that? You know, why not? Why not wait and play locally? And if you got to wear a sweater, wear a sweater. You got to wear a sweater and a down vest, wear that. I mean, you know, I think there are some answers there that they never had to use because they had the money to do whatever they wanted.
And now we'll see it completely different. And I wanted to get your perspective on how the Power Five commissioners plus Notre Dame have handled this in 5 months. Because Ivan, I said this in March, in April, in June, and even in July. The one benefit that college football had, as well as the NFL, was time was on their side. And it felt like they could never get on the same page. Now, it's a novel virus, and it's ever-evolving, and information is coming in that's brand new every single day. But what do you think is going to happen here with the Power Five leadership down the road in shaping college football moving forward? Because, you know, we know that the NCAA doesn't have a say. We've seen this play out right in front of us, at least in decision-making on the future of who's playing and who's not in this specific sport. What do you think is going to change down the road here when it comes to future decision-making and finding a unified front?
Absolutely nothing is going to change. And I'll tell you why. There's a couple of reasons, Kevin. One, well, first of all, it's a regional sport. And you know what? It's a regional virus. I just don't believe there is one national one-size-fits-all solution to the issues at play here. You know, if the virus is going to break out in different parts of the country at different times and at different strengths. And, you know, I just don't think there is a national solution to this issue. You know, and what you're hinting at in your question is, you know, why don't we have a central governing body for college football?
Yes.
Well, when the Supreme Court in the mid-80s returned the television rights from the NCAA to the schools ceded those rights to the conferences. And that's why we have powerful conferences. And it's just not part of human nature to give up power willingly. There's no reason that the commissioners have to cede control of their biggest money-making sport to a Roger Goodell. You know, they just don't see a way that that benefits them. And, you know, if you ask, I was trying to think of who and I could ever think of that gave up power willingly. And, you know, and I got to George Washington, and after that, that was all I could come up with. So, it's not going to happen. You know,
you went deep there. Somebody, yeah.
Do what?
You went deep there to find George Washington.
Yeah. Well, he was kind of a big deal. But, you know, that other than that, you know, they're not going to give up. We have an oligarchy. We have five people. And if you want to throw Swarbrick in there, great. You know, Jack Swarbrick at Notre Dame, who run the sport. And until somebody can convince them they'd be better off giving their power to somebody else, that's what we got.
And giving up power also, can that translate to we just don't trust anybody? And we only trust ourselves, and we don't – that means you could even suggest we don't trust other commissioners, right? I mean, can you go as far as to saying that? We just trust ourselves. We know what's best for our constituents.
Well, sure. And I should point out that the one place where they have worked together very well and done better than certainly I expected, and I think most of us expected, is the playoff. You know, the commissioners got together and they run a very efficient, smart, effective money-making playoff. So the model, when they see that they should work together, is there. Here, for whatever reason, and again, it, you know, I think it goes back to power, and I think it goes back to the regional threat of the virus, they have not found a reason to work together. You know, none of us understand why, but, you know, they didn't. So this is what we got.
When we continue the conversation on the commissioners, I do want to recognize Greg Sankey, because it felt like in this storm over the last 4 or 5 days, starting on Saturday after the Max decision, he's always, regardless of the outcome, he has always put out a calm front. And no matter what, it has always felt united. We are lockstep. We are going to be aware of what everybody's doing, but at the same time, I'm not pressing the panic button. He's even included that in his messaging. And honestly, that is true leadership when you're just, we're not pressing the panic button. We will make a decision, but we will not be going by, you know, the waves that we are feeling right now. Ultimately, we'll decide something down the road. I do not know what that final decision will be, but at the same time, he's giving a sense of calmness to the other side here. And I go to Kevin Warren because he is put in such a tough spot in your first year replacing Jim Delaney. And then you see what's happening. The cracks. I've never seen a statement, as I mentioned to Mark, I've never seen a statement issued by the chancellor, president, AD and coach like Nebraska going against a commissioner. That doesn't happen. And Mark suggested it, and I agree. That doesn't happen if Jim Delaney's the commissioner. What kind of pressure is Kevin Warren going through right now in his first year, especially when one of your constituents is speaking out publicly against you the way they did?
Yeah, it's not the model we're used to seeing the way a conference runs, and certainly the Jim Delaney's and Mike Slives of the world made sure that their people, and they did it through charm and through discipline, they made sure their people were marching behind them. Now, would that have happened in their first year in office in this kind of crisis? I don't know. You know, it's clear, you know, that this has been as you pointed out, it's an emotional decision. And I think you have to allow Nebraska to be emotional. You know, they're not going anywhere, and they can complain all they want, but contractually, I don't know how they would extricate themselves from the Big Ten. The Big 12 doesn't want them, you know. So, it's not a good look, but Kevin Warren's got bigger issues to deal with. And let me just say one thing about Greg Sankey, Kevin. He's an extremely analytical guy. He's extremely intelligent. And what he's figured out is why I don't understand everyone else didn't figure out. Don't make a decision until you have to make a decision. You know, he pushed the starting date back to September 26th. For this very reason. And, you know, he doesn't have to decide yet. And that date is coming up, you know, probably by the end of the month. You know, you're going to have to, do you need 3 weeks lead time? Do you need four? But doesn't have to decide now. So he's not doing it.
Yeah, it's a credit to him on handling adversity, regardless of the outcome. Again, in these times when sometimes the loudest person gets the most attention, he has found a way to just say, hey, we are not going to lose our head at this moment. We are going to find a way to figure it out. And if we can't figure it out, we will have an answer for you down the road when we're ready to give it to you. So I admire him in handling something like this. Going forward here, a couple questions left. Are we going to have spring football in your mind?
Who doesn't want to go to the Rose Bowl on Easter weekend? I think we're going to have fall football and spring football. So, you know, this may turn out better than anybody's expected. And, you know, I don't know how we are going to determine a national champion. Maybe we bring back the polls for this year. You know, of course, they'd be leaving a lot of money on the table. I don't know. There's so many questions like that have to be answered. To answer your question, I think we're going to have football in the fall in some form or fashion, and we're going to have it sometime after January 1st into the winter and spring.
Wow. I love your optimism. I hope it happens. And, you know, and honestly, in previous years, it would be the end of the world conversations about who's number one. If we're even having a debate about polls and who's number one, that means we've got football in front of us to debate about. Right. And that would be an incredible thing. Ivan, I appreciate your perspective here. And hopefully the next time we have you on, we're talking about football on the field and more conversations about how come this person decided to go for it in this situation, and what are the ramifications long-term here the rest of the season on decision-making on the field. We appreciate the time. We hope everybody's safe and healthy on your side.
You too. Thanks, Kevin.
That'll do it for this podcast. Big thanks to our guests here. That is Ivan Maisel, Reese Davis, and Mark Schlabaugh, as well as Taylor Schwenk, always doing a great job in coordinating as, you know, it's an obstacle course to say, all right, when are we going to tape? Because will we be able to finish this taping and air it before new news would break out? And very fluid situation. And I can assure you that we will continue to bring you the very latest information that we have with our fantastic reporters, as well as our guests that give us perspective long-term and what it means. And I promise you that we will have previews down the road. As of right now, each and every week we bring the podcast along with our guests. We will have great newsbreakers joining us with their perspective and what they're hearing about potentially having college football in the fall. If you want college football, we hope you enjoy the rest of the summer. We hope you're safe, and we hope you have practiced social distancing and you wear a mask. Until the next time, be safe and enjoy the summer.